Serious TV Drama Podcast. I'm Scott, and joining me tonight, well, first, my usual partner in crime is here. Hey, Dan, how you doing?
Oh, I thought you were talking to Brian. I'm doing okay. Hi, guys.
Hey, Dan.
And so it begins. Yes, we are also being joined by Brian. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Scott. Hey, Dan.
Good evening.
And, you know, statistic-wise, Brian, Dan might be right about that over the last few years, but no, that's a matter for another podcast that no one will ever listen to. We are here. We are finally up to the final season of Breaking Bad. And as folks remember, if you go back in time roughly 10 years ago, that season was actually broken into two halves way back when. And it was at this point on the, let's call it the zeitgeist timeline, that people were finally sitting up and taking notice of Breaking Bad. So the rating for the final season was far higher than any of the previous four. This is when people started really actively talking about it. They were catching up on it via Netflix, or AMC kept doing marathons of it, and so on. The series, once they hit their final season, it had finally, quote-unquote, had become a big deal. So, and of course, all of us were watching all along, or at least it started, you know, midway during its run. We were like, well, we told you so. I always kind of got a kick out of that because I feel like when you're watching a show that doesn't seem to be on everybody's radar, on one hand, you're trying to push it on people, but on the other hand, you always feel kind of possessive over it as well. Do you guys know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like when you like a cool band,
right?
And then all of a sudden, like, they become really popular, and you're like, that's my band. I don't want douchebag frat boys to like my band.
Right. But at least with Breaking Bad, as opposed to a lot of bands, unfortunately, Breaking Bad stayed true to itself as far as their quality and what they did. And you can never say Breaking Bad sold out the way sometimes our bands tend to. Ooh. There's some gas there. So, with all that said, let's crack open season 5. Season 5, the first episode was Live Free or Die. It was directed by Michael Slovis and written by, of course, Vince Gilligan. Now, this was the one where when we kicked off the season premiere, we kicked it off with an opening that, you know, was in true Breaking Bad style. It was as intriguing as all get out. You know, it's Walt's 52nd birthday, which means we're watching an honest-to-goodness flash forward. Forwarding a year later, and we see that Walt has a full head of hair, a full beard, and his lungs sound like they're full of cancerous cells, too, when you hear his bone-rattling cough. We know from the license plate he's been living in New Hampshire, and he's in town to meet with one of our favorite dudes from Deadwood again, only this time he's there to buy one serious piece of military hardware. I know that the two of you, you're both big fans of Jim Beaver from his work on Deadwood, as well as Dan. Wasn't he like
Supernatural?
All right, he was in Supernatural.
He was great on that.
Wasn't he like a big time blogger or something like that? That something with social media where Jim Beaver had a lot of followers.
Yeah, he's got a pretty good following and stuff on Facebook. Whatever, you know, he'll post about, you know, progressive political issues, you know.
Right. But he's on Supernatural also. But he's also one of those great ways of how we first get into Deadwood, if I recall, because we spend so much time with his character in that in the very first episode of Deadwood, if I'm not mistaken, when he goes on one of these great monologues when he's at the bar and stuff. It's really, anyway, he's a great actor. So, getting back to the series, I think the most common refrain that we kept hearing that was used to describe Walt's ascendancy, or maybe it's his descent, I don't know, to crime lord, is Scarface. And when you see that piece of military hardware, you know, you can certainly imagine Tony Montana toting that badass gun into war when you see the thing that's in his trunk, I thought.
Yeah, which is foreshadows a scene in this arc we're going to talk about. And I want to add about Jim Beaver, Scott. I don't know if you know this, but it's kind of interesting. He also is sort of a minor historian about Superman, about the actor. I don't know if it's just George Reeves, but he did a lot of apparently research and has written some blog posts or responses or articles or stuff about Superman. So
I did not know that. Now I like him even more.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, really kind of interesting.
Yeah, he's really smart, thorough.
I should see if he wants to join me on a podcast one day. Just talk about Superman. Now, one trick that they try to set up with when we see that gun is, you know, we're going to spend the rest of the season is seeing how we can now imagine Walter White in the same way as, you know, as that in that Tony Montana moment. Now, I thought this entire episode was really dotted with several moments that kind of brought a little bit of a smile to my face when I watched it again, because I think one of the fun parts about doing a rewatch is the way we react to it now, and we also remember how we reacted to it when we and processed the information when we first saw it. So that, I think that's become one of the great things about doing this rewatch. I'm realizing for myself personally, I've watched a lot of these episodes several times over, except for the fifth season. This is actually going to be the first time I've done a rewatch of the fifth season, by the way. Other than when I watched them maybe that one week on when they were on, when I was podcasting with the Geek Girl Soup gang way back when. It's amazing for someone like myself who claims to be, you know, oh, I know so much about Breaking Bad. And then there'll be a scene here, a scene that's like, I totally forgot about that. You know, it's just, I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's two interesting responses I've had rewatching, and that is when you watch it the first time, your response is more emotional. When you watch it the second time, it's more intellectual, that you're analyzing how everything worked, knowing where it's going and where it started. And so you catch things that you don't maybe necessarily catch the first time because you're reacting more emotionally to the story and you don't know where it's going. And like you said, I think probably the most pleasing part of a rewatch is the little bits and pieces that you forgot, that you're like, oh yeah, like that happened or this scene happened. And those are very pleasing as well, to sort of find those hidden gems that you forgot about.
Right. Right. And for myself, one of the things I'm enjoying doing now more so than I might've done watching it 10, 12, whatever years ago, I can take the time to admire certain things that maybe I didn't do then, like from the quote unquote, you know, writer's perspective, I can admire a line even more now and not the obvious lines, like Walt's badass lines, and it's something like, you know, because I said so, or we're done when I say we're done. And that little, and of course, The added thing I think for us now is when we're watching a lot of these scenes that also involve Saul Goodman, and that's also feeding into us being fans of Better Call Saul. And that also changes how we look at these scenes now as well. I know that we were all Bob Odenkirk fans and Saul Goodman fans before, but we might have a bit more, shall I say, empathy for Saul Goodman than we might have before, because we've grown to love him as, you know, in his Jimmy McGill persona, so to speak. So I think that also colors some of these scenes a bit more than before, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we're kind of rooting for him.
Yeah. And I kind of get the impression, too, that, I view the show a little bit more emotionally now, because I'm kind of coming at it from a different angle after, I don't know, some unpleasant personal stuff a couple of years ago. So I kind of see Walt in a more different way as time passes. And I kind of, just in the way that I get the feeling that after seeing the different kind of interactions that Saul's going to have with, like, Lalo, for example, in the season we haven't seen yet of Better Call Saul, I think that the way that Walt treats him, as Walt becomes more of a kind of, you know, megalomaniac or whatever, just the way that, you know, like when, like in one of these episodes here where Walt really gets up in his personal space and stuff like that, the way he acts, like, just kind of feels like really unpleasant and unfamiliar or familiar. And I kind of think that after we see, you know, like see the last season Better Call Saul, that like stuff like that will seem even more like relevant, you know, like it's just gonna, you know, like instead of just seeing Saul as some kind of like slimy, like cowardly lawyer, like we might actually like see him as like remembering things that actually had happened before. And like, yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You're right. It's funny because I know you've mentioned several times in the previous Breaking Bad podcast of how your perspective has shifted and how, specifically in how you see Walt. And I'm not exactly, and I had said I wasn't exactly with you on that. No, not that that matters. However, I would say doing this rewatch, I have a much greater understanding, not just you, but for anyone who had become very much anti-Walt, you know, at whatever point during the series, because you can certainly see, I certainly see much more reason to. And there are certain things like, oh, it feels more clear that there's more to not like, that he is becoming the villain, you know, at a much earlier stage than maybe I had thought about it when I watched it the last time I went through the series, where I thought of that being more of a, I tended to think of it more as a fifth season and meet really once we get to the midway point where it's, you know, Walt versus Hank and then Walt versus Jesse, whatever. But doing the rewatch, I'm like, okay, I can see why one would want to get off that train, you know, no foreshadowing to a future episode, a hell of a lot earlier, whether it goes all the way back to the second season or the third season or whatever. I understand it more now. I totally believe it's certainly a valid point of view, and
it just, you know, totally get it. Well, you know, but for me, you know, I'm just, you know, adding personal stuff into the situation and just changes the way you see certain things. I mean, you know, each time I watch the show, I kind of become like, you know, more against Walt, less against Skyler as time goes, and this season's definitely quite different. But it's just, you know, just depending on the, you know, the kind of things that happened in your life and stuff, you just see things differently, you know. So if I watch Gaslight right now, it'd be a lot, I guess I would be a little bit less thrilled with the main character, or, you know, the villain of that and whatever. And you can just, you know, see certain things just the way that, you know, like for example, jumping ahead, like when Walt tells Marie about Skyler's infidelity, I mean, like what he's doing there, it makes me feel pretty uncomfortable, you know, even if though Skyler's not in that scene, I just, you know, I understand what he's doing there on a couple different levels, and it's pretty skeevy.
Well, I think personal experiences in one way or another will always impact and color how you view anything. That somehow you can relate to what you've experienced, for good or for bad. Yeah. So that makes perfect sense.
One of the strengths of this show too, and the writers on this show and, you know, the other show, is just, you know, they're willing to tell a story that, you know, can make people feel uncomfortable on different levels and stuff like that. But it just feels authentic without feeling the least bit, you know, they're not being manipulative or trying to make us like dislike Walt necessarily. He's just kind of acting like the way that he should be acting, and, you know, and it's up to the viewer to interpret it the way that they want to, I guess.
Right.
I totally agree with everything you guys said, and I think the way I would describe watching it this time is that all of my feelings are much more nuanced than when I first watched it. That I probably like Walt a lot less, but I still have empathy for him. I like Skyler more and have more empathy for her than I probably did. But then there's the interesting thing of, like, Mike. When you watch it without the context of 5-0 and Saul and that stuff, that you know, Mike is just this stone cold badass that sometimes you like and sometimes you think he's a jerk. But you watch it like the episodes we watched for this, like, you know, I had a whole different frame to watch Mike through. And I found it very interesting how I reacted to him and how I felt for him. Whereas when him and Walt would butt heads, I don't know that I cared who won and who lost. And now maybe I do in a different way. So it is interesting to look through that window. I mean, neither of them are heroes or good guys, but there is some shading to the character of Mike that seeing it was interesting to me watching these episodes.
Right. It's funny you should mention it because as much as I love the Mike character, both on this and especially from Better Call Saul, and generally speaking, that's a guy I want to root for more often than not. However, there's something I find very satisfying when, like, say, in the Mike versus Walt moments, when Walt turns out to get the upper hand or actually be right. Because it's not going to, it's something that, you know, doesn't happen with Mike very often. And I like Mike being fallible. You know, and I kind of, because up until a certain point on the show, he wasn't presented that way. I mean, the most was the fact that Walt got the better of them when Jesse kills Gale at the end of season 3, and he kind of pulled it on them, whatever. But I think that's also the beginning of the unraveling of Mike to a very slight degree on the show, you know, and how, like, me and Dan talked about the killing of Victor. While, you know, one could say, oh, sending a message, you know, to Walt and Jesse sitting there, I think we agreed he's also sending a message to Mike. And you can tell by Mike's reaction in that scene as well. So it's interesting. And then just summing up, one last thing about what we're all saying about just Walt in general and, you know, not liking whatever, it gets into the likability factor. And what you guys were saying about admiring the writing of the show and Gilligan, etc., for not shying away from having a character and a storyline that might make us uncomfortable, it might cause us not to like the main character more so and more so as time goes on. I've talked about this, you know, all the live long day. I'm all for that. I love, that's maybe one of the reasons I love the show, is that it doesn't worry about the likability factor of its main character. I mean, I know people who didn't like Walt from season one, from the get-go. I didn't understand it, but I know people who, but they watched it anyway because they were just, they found the storyline compelling, even if they didn't like the main character. But it goes to my thing where I get into arguments, whether it be with people in the business, whatever, about not worrying about whether how likable your main character is. And I think they don't worry about it here. And those who say otherwise, like, well, Martin Scorsese built his career basing his work around unlikable characters, and it worked out pretty well for him. And people, you know, does anyone like Travis Bickle? Does anyone like Jake LaMotta? Come on. Anyway, where was I? All right, so let's get back to.
Getting back to it. I thought the line where Jim Beaver like doesn't want Walt to bring the gun across the border, I thought that was just kind of like an interesting little bit of characterization for him.
Yes, I love a line that says a lot by saying very little, and what that actually meant. I enjoyed that as well. That's a good catch there.
He'll take a man at his word, but he still wants to make sure the specific thing doesn't happen. And it says a lot, and you know, 10 words or whatever.
Right. So I think I think I'm going through my little notes here and all the little points that I kind of like maybe love. Reasons I love the episode kind of thing, or things I remembered both watching it now and watching it then. I mean, the first one of all things was the actual, remembering when I first watched it, when we watched this episode when it first aired, there was actually a surprise, even though we talked about it before, we shouldn't have been surprised, but I'll admit, back when I watched this episode for the first time, the surprise that Ted was alive. Because I think when we were watching way back when, we kind of thought he might have broke his neck. We actually talked about that before. We realized, he's fine. But I think we weren't focusing on things when we watched season four way back when. And we thought, did they just kill Ted? Well, but no, he's not. He's just in heavy traction, but he's not dead. The other things I liked about it were obviously the return of Mike and the beginning of what I would call was an uneasy alliance with Walt, which then sets up a very interesting dynamic for the next several episodes, which when, as we watch those next four and we know what's going to happen in the ones after that, it's like, oh, you've created this situation where it's combustible from the get-go, and now we're just going to wait for it to explode, because Mike pretty much calls it himself, you know, right from the start, as far as working with Walt. And so now, it's funny, when you watch it now, it's like, well, what's the word I'm looking for? I'm struggling for a word on a podcast. It's really not good. Inevitable. When you watch it now, even if you didn't know, like, oh, it feels inevitable that Mike is going to die due to Walt or by Walt's hand when you watch it now. Whereas I think we were shocked when we saw it the first time around.
Right. And it's the classic flaw of Mike that, as you said, like, he's completely infallible, but he has a couple of weaknesses. And in this instance, it's Jesse. Like, if Jesse's not there, he blows Walt away. But Jesse gets in between them. And clearly, like, he sees potential in Jesse, and he sees something in Jesse that he can't do it. I mean, I don't think he really had a change of heart and didn't want to kill him. I think he just didn't kill him because of Jesse.
Right. Oh, and speaking of Jesse, one of the best things about this episode, I love the fact that it wasn't the grizzled, war-weary, ex-cop turned fixer, hitman, or the budding crime genius who comes up with the idea of how to dispose of the laptop evidence, but it's Jesse.
Yeah.
I love that. And I think it's by when we get to this season and from this episode on, you start to realize, if you hadn't already, that Jesse is the heart and soul of the show from this point on, for sure, you know?
Yeah, and it's like the difference between the old guard and the new guard, that the old guys are talking about how in the world are you going to set fire or blow up something, and this kid with an understanding of electronics says just use a magnet, like, you know, and if you watch that scene, Jesse says it several times, and at first it's very soft, and then it grows louder until finally, you know, he interrupts them to say magnets. And it's really quiet. It's a moment for Jesse. We're in a room full of these giants. Like, he's proving to be the equal of both of them.
Right. Right. I love that scene, because it's also the way they frame it. So, like you said, it's, they are like giants in the frame, and Jesse is very minimized, you know, in the foreground there, almost like a child compared to these two older bald men, you know, and that happens. Yeah. Oh, and just to be silly, hey, today I love noticing the fact that finally Walt and Jesse have decent looking ski masks. Because isn't it more than once that they wear the silly ones? I think it happens in two different episodes.
Yeah.
And finally they upgraded.
They wear when they're stealing the methylamine and when they're intimidating Saul.
Right. That's the Saul scene. And speaking of Saul, every moment Saul's on screen in this episode is, you know, it's a special treat, I think. But possibly for me, the most special treat of all, as far as smile inducing, I would say, the reappearance of the most savvy and accommodating junkyard dude this the side of Fred Sanford, man, old Joe. Old Joe is just—he's a treasure. The little bit where he starts to talk about what he's, when he realizes he's talking about cock rings, and Jesse's like, why is everybody looking at me? Yeah. That's just special stuff. So, yeah. So, like I said, this first episode, it was at the time a very triumphant return for Breaking Bad. I mean, like I said, the ratings this episode got was higher than any episode had gotten before, including Face Off, whatever. But it's just one of those things where everyone gets a little bit of share of time in this episode, and you realize how much you really enjoy all of them and how they all play important parts. They all add layer upon layer in terms of backstory and future plotting, and we're going to see how this is all going to work out brilliantly in their final season, both comically and tragically as we move forward. So I don't know if I consulted with my old top 25 list before I got ready tonight. So I won't worry about it. I don't know if that was in there or not. So I'm going to move to the next episode then. The next episode would be Madrigal, which was directed by Michelle MacLaren, who's directed so many of these episodes, and again written by Vince Gilligan. It's nice to see him writing back-to-back ones here. Now, I do remember being, let's say, iffy way back when on the idea that the Germans might be the new big bad on the show. But, you know, I remember thinking then, as well as forever, it's Breaking Bad, you're going to give Vince Gilligan and company the benefit of the doubt. I think there's a little bit of irony, or I don't know if I don't want to misuse the word irony like the rest of the world. I think there's a funny coincidence that when you're watching it, this episode, you're like, oh wait, the Germans are behind everything? And then who the enemies turn out to be towards the latter part of the season. It's like, well, you know, they are Nazis. they're just American Nazis. Just thought of that just now.
How little did we know the future would be predicted by something other than The Simpsons?
That is true. And going back to what we were just saying about, you know, the unlikability of Walt or the opportunities that the show creates for us to not like Walt, it's really, really hard to like Walt when you're watching Jesse falling apart in that scene early on in this episode. That's real. I mean, it's some great acting by Aaron Paul as well, but ooh, it's, yeah, that's it's funny watching this season now. You're going like, wow, it is really hard to like Walt.
and that grows like sort of. This is where when Jesse's strong and you see him being stronger, that when he's weak, Walt pounces in a way that he doesn't even need to, like, but he just can't help himself. And I think that's what's so distasteful. I mean, he has Jesse completely where he wants him.
Finally.
And he can run it, you know, without Gus, without all the other stuff overlooking his shoulder. And we see, you know, later he has gotten Skylar to submission, but that's not enough. He's got to completely dominate her to try to create a fake perfect family, and he just can't stop. And it's the same with the money. It's his classic character flaw. He just can't quit when he's ahead.
Right. It's interesting with the, especially with the Jesse stuff, because, you know, I always feel like there's a certain satisfaction Walt has of, you know, it seemed like he was losing Jesse in season 4 because he was going off with Mike all the time. And, you know, so Mike was almost supplanting him as that, mentor father type of figure to Jesse that Walt had sort of had, but never really made that strong use of because he was so busy fighting with Jesse all the time. And if I'm going to be anti-Walt, the fact that it almost calls into question any scene where he's being friendly to him this season. Like a later episode when they're sitting together just having a beer and they're having a conversation, everything is suspect. everything that Walt says feels like it may very well be calculated. It's manipulative to some degree. And you realize it is, and we've said before, I think we've said season after season, one of the interesting things about Walt, and this is extremely deliberate, he takes on aspects of the personas of those he's vanquished. You know? He does it from season to season. And that, what he's doing with Jesse, especially, again, we're not up to that episode, but who cares? That kind of thing, that's very Gus Fring. It's very Gus Fring. It reminds me of conversations that Gus had with Jesse himself, in fact. It's very similar to that, in fact. So when I was watching it this time, I was going, oh, this is him. He's taking on a little bit of the, oh, there he is. Anyway. So, Mike. This is a very Mike episode. By the way, for old school movie fans like me, like Dan, even probably to some degree, I think, I was thrilled to see that Mike was watching the Caine Mutiny. I'm a big fan of that movie. It actually caused me to go and read stuff about it, and I was like, oh, I forgot how much I love this movie. And I could spend another hour just talking about the Caine Mutiny. And for people who don't know what the hell I'm talking about, we're talking about the Caine Mutiny movie. It was the movie based on the play, the Trial of the Caine Mutiny. That's the movie with Humphrey Bogart and Fred McMurray and Van Johnson and so on and so forth. It's one of those great Bogart performance movies, I think. Even though there's a lot of other great stuff, Jose Ferrer is really good in it as well. But getting back
to... And another eerie foreshadowing, the same way Scarface was in these episodes when Walt's watching Scarface, like, you know, the downfall of the Kingpin, the guy whose, you know, allegiances start to run amok, and, you know, it's sort of like these windows into what's going to happen to these guys.
Right. Oh, and one of the best parts about this episode, which thrilled me, the interrogation scene with Hank, you got to know, these guys must have loved doing that scene. I mean, if it's not the highlight of, I don't know, I say it's the highlight of the entire episode, and I would die to see any deleted scenes taken from that, but just the back and forth between Hank and Mike and whatever, which also becomes a bit more interesting when we think about stuff that happens in, you know, Better Call Saul, but we'll leave that aside for now. It's truly one of the notable things here. Oh, I always like to point out when we meet someone that's of note, we do meet Lydia in this episode. We actually see her in the earlier scene at the meeting with the magical contingent and the authorities, but her true intro is the scene at the diner. That's a great character intro. It's perhaps maybe a little bit more comical than I would have expected considering what her character is throughout most of the series, but I love the contrast between her and, you know, the deep sighing world weary Mike and that whole sequence that happens at the diner. It's just one thing after the other. Even when she refers to him by a different name in front of the waitress, and the waitress clearly knows it's Mike because this is his local joint. I love that thing. And also, let's give them credit. You know, they knew what they were doing. One of the very first things we hear from her is talking about her stevia. So they established that right off the bat with her. I really thought that was a great little bit there too.
Yeah, I love that scene because it's a microcosm of Mike in that whatever environment he's in, he knows, like, anywhere he meets somebody, anytime he's doing something, he's sussed it out. And so he's meeting her at a place where he knows the people, you know, there's nothing weird going to happen. If you go meet Mike somewhere that Mike decides, and you see that sort of control that he has over the environments. And I like where he says, you know, are you coming to me or am I coming to you? And she says, just look forward. He goes, well, I guess that means I'm coming to you. And he just gets up and walks over. It's just a great Mike moment.
Yeah. It's a very nice moment there. Try to think of other things I really enjoyed or that stuck out about the episode. One of them would have to be, speaking of Hank earlier, when Asak Merkit is talking about his experience with Fring, the fact that at a certain point in that conversation and everything moving forward, it's an exact parallel of Hank and Walt, except Hank just doesn't know it yet. And it's just one of those nice, clean pieces of writing. I was like, oh, that's very nice. It's like, oh, look at that. You know, this is, this is basically what's going to happen. This is Hank and Walt. It's just, we're just substituting different names right now. I got a big kick out of that. Now, I'm just looking at something I had written a while back about this episode, and I guess it was something about Skylar. I'm just going through all this. I feel a lot of what I had in my notes. Some of these notes were written way back when. I feel we've kind of gone over in podcast after podcast. It's basically a defense of Skylar. So I don't really know if I need to go into all this right now. I just love noting that she might be the only, way back when, she was the only decent mom on any American Movie Classics TV show way back when, because every mother that appeared on every other show then was just a horrible person. I'm just, flipping through this as I stall just a little bit. So I'm going to skip over all this because I don't know why I had all these notes. All right.
I liked how the Madrigal executive washroom had like a red toilet paper holder that seemed to have like some kind of light making the toilet paper also look red.
Oh yeah. Well, the fact that they went in for the okay, let's make this bathroom look as much like the bathroom from The Shining as possible. You know, let's just a wash in red. So talk about relating things to your personal life, whatever. I actually had been considering doing that recently. And then all of a sudden rational thought took over, like, no, you don't want an all red bathroom. You'll go more insane than you already are. Don't do that.
Well, I thought you were saying you're going to like kill yourself with a defibrillator after eating tater tots. So I'm glad you didn't do that.
No, I think my death will come soon based on things I eat, but I don't think the defibrillator will be involved. I loved him eating the tater tots. Just, it's so good.
All the different sauces, like the way it was filmed, and it was so arty the way they filmed him dip the things into the sauces. It was a really beautiful opening sequence. And when I first watched it, I remember as soon as I saw it what happened, but it was odd. I remember the first time I watched it thinking like, oh, this is really weird. This guy eats tater tots and then goes and kills himself.
Go on.
Oh, this, when we get together in Raleigh this year, we should eat tater tots out of a fishbowl also.
This dressing is a mixture of French and ranch. We call it French. He should have done like a Dr. Evil thing when he said that. Like, wow. Really. Anyway, I'm going to switch serious now. Because I think this is what this episode came down to for me. Look, I get that we are watching Walt's tragic. I say tragic. Well, no, it is. It's a tragic journey down the road to being a master criminal. And the excuse, you know, that he was doing this all for his family, it's just a little more than a distant memory now with this character. Even when he says he's broke, which is, you know, maybe it's mostly Skylar's fault, but she did it for the right reasons at the time. And we can appreciate the challenge the show, as we've been saying, is constantly presenting. You know, at what point does someone no longer care or root for Walter White? The way we're talking right now sounds like none of us are right now. I'm still a little bit, you know, because I don't, you know, it depends. But this episode, this is the one that kind of, it started to really lose me. It's the downright creepy way he's treating Skylar. It actually bothers me more than any other attempted or fully realized murder or depraved indifference or the fact he indirectly caused the death of hundreds of people. Because Walt is not a moron. He must be able to see just how frightened and fucked up his wife is over realizing that his husband, he's not just a meth cook, he's a murderer. But when you get to that last scene in bed, it's hard for not to say that it doesn't feel like it's kind of bordering on rape.
It's rapey as hell. It's when I watched it this time, I was 10 times more creeped out than probably the first time I watched it. I was super creeped out, and it was like watching an abusive person, you know, trying to cuddle up with the person they've abused and say, "Don't worry, I've got it under control and everything's okay." And she's literally cowering. Right. You know, it was terrible.
Right. You know, so the way I feel, you know, on one hand, I want to say hats off to them for making me feel uncomfortable, but you know, for making me seriously question my feelings about Walt back then, when there's still so many episodes to go of Breaking Bad. I mean, could I take some issues with Skyler, the way Skyler kind of wavers in her thought pattern, the way she feels about certain things? Slightly, but at the end of the day, it's hard to forgive Walt for the way he's acting. He's acting in a way which is very disturbing. Let's leave it at that.
Well, it's hard to imagine just expecting somebody to be totally cool when they know people were on their way to their house to kill them because of you. Like, you know, if people were literally coming to kill the entire family, and like you just want that person to get over it. I mean, that's pretty heavy. I mean, regardless of dealing drugs is one thing, but getting involved with the kind of people that kill your whole family, mm-hmm. that was a lot on her. And I think I remember the first time I watched the show, what she says in a couple of episodes to him in the bedroom when they have the big fight. Mm-hmm. Like I thought, wow, that kind of sucks out of her. But after watching these episodes back to back this time, like this is the groundwork of why she says what she says, because he's truly treating her in a way that's basically a domestic violence situation that, you know, like you can't leave me, you're trapped, and I'm going to gaslight you and say terrible things to you and treat you this way such that she feels like there's no escape. And that scene was just terrible. Right. And I think you hit the nail on the head. Like it was really, really creepy in a way that I thought it was bad, but it creeped me out a lot more this time.
Right. Absolutely.
And plus the fact that she also knows that he bombed a nursing home. And I mean, like, no matter how smart he is, he could say he's going to like calculate the yield and make sure like, you know, nobody in a Jason room is going to get destroyed. But, you know, if Hector decides to face his wheelchair a different direction just because he doesn't give a shit, you know, they could, you know, a few other people could have just got killed. And I'm sure she probably, you know, I mean, he bombed a nursing home.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
But one thing I can say in defense of Walt, not this, is that if Lydia, who's clearly a complete space case, is able to get one of Mike's guys to flip, maybe Walt's idea that Mike's other guys need to get whacked isn't necessarily, you know, him thinking improperly. Because if Chris is willing to do that, I mean, you know, I wouldn't say the other guys, even though they've been vetted, are necessarily trustworthy. So his instinct to do that, you know, on a purely criminal level is, I think it's probably validated by this episode.
Oh, yeah. I never had an issue with him doing that. I understood it.
Yeah.
It was just more the fact of such a major undertaking where it's total Godfather when we get there. But yeah, and you're absolutely right. This episode kind of makes that point. It's like, look what happened. How can you trust these people? And you know what? That money should all be coming out of his share anyway. Let's move on.
But it does show that Mike does have a line that is too far. And that is, you can't just start killing everyone. And Walt's ready to walk across that line.
Hmm. My only problem with that is, yeah, but meanwhile, you went down to Mexico with your boss not that long ago and watched as he just basically killed, you know, 30, 40 people poolside. I still can't figure out how they were able to pour that many shots of tequila, but but not one of the girls had it. Anyway. All right, season 5, we're up to episode 3 now. Hazard Pay. which was directed by Adam Bernstein and written by, yay, our Better Call Saul dude, Peter Gould. This is an episode that features one of my favorite lines of the series. Just because you shot Jesse James don't make you Jesse James. Just, I love that line. Just love it. And of course, it's one of those lines, once you hear the line, you already know who said it. You don't need to be told. It's Mike. And in this episode, I think like Mike is a rock, but Walt is the hard place. And, you know, despite that line that I just said, you can't help when you're watching this episode but think Mike might be underestimating Walt. This is despite Mike referring to him as trouble, as a ticking time bomb previously this season. He still tends to underestimate Walt. What's very interesting, and again, you can't really take away from the show because of what was later done on Better Call Saul, which takes place in the past, because those scripts hadn't been written yet. That hadn't happened, you know? But it is very interesting when you watch this episode now and you have, like, the fact that Saul is totally against Mike joining the little enterprise. And he's just referring to how Mike had threatened to, like, you know, break his legs and stuff before. It's one of those things where I keep thinking, did they know? They were always thinking about doing the Saul show. I don't know if they really thought that they were going to make it Saul and Mike. So I wonder about that when I see a scene like that.
Yeah, I wonder that, but I think there is a sense that Saul has as yet undiscovered information Walter doesn't have about how these things go. That Saul is maybe a little more savvy about, you know, how these criminal enterprises run and how things go based on his experience. And, you know, he sees that if it grows beyond the three of them and their little thing, the implications coming down the road. And, you know, he actually turns out to be pretty wise, to what's happening and what can happen. And yet again, you know, another stop sign, Walt blows past and continues down the road. But I love that scene. And the talking about Mike and Walt, the thing I love about them facing off is, you know, Walt's a really bright guy who has great ideas a lot of times. Mike knows how to make it happen, and Walt starts to assume he can do what Mike does and tries to go down that road. Mike knows he can't make meth. Like, Mike does know his limitations, but in his own sphere of what he does, I think he overestimates, you know, how much Walt is studying and learning enough to try to turn on him. And, you know, when he says the thing to Jesse walking out of the garage, you know, about maybe Gus was trying to teach Mike something. Maybe it wasn't just me and you, you know, you see Walt has snapped. And the thing I wonder, and I've thought about this, about throwing this out to you guys and see what you think. Do you think things would have went on for a longer period of time if Mike just hadn't taken the money? Because it's a very interesting visual that Mike lays all that money out on the table and then takes it away from him. And that is that, because Walt is interested about the money and the power, that's sort of almost a slight to Walt, to put the money on the table and take it away from him. And then he has this little pile. If Mike had just, say, taken care of the guys out of his end, would that have prolonged their relationship? Or do you think the fact that he embarrassed Walt in that way, that Walt only got the $137,000, that ramped this up to a faster conclusion?
I think it ramped it up. I think when they made their deal, you know, Walt handles the manufacturing, he handles the business, and this is the business, and this is not what Walt imagined. And the fact that he points out, even if Jesse's right about, you know, but we're owners now, it's ours. But Walt is still, but it's not, then again, Walt is all about being in control. And he's not in control of this now. He's ceded control, and he's not getting what he wants out of it. And he's being spoken to in a certain way. And Walt is past that. So I think this whole sequence with the money is what accelerates what's eventually going to happen between the two of them. If he had taken the money out of his, if he had said from the get-go, I'm going to make my guys whole again, but that's on me, you know, I got to take responsibility, whatever. Then maybe that doesn't happen. I think maybe that doesn't happen. At least not yet. I think it still eventually does happen, but I think this was just, what you were describing with the money, it's a nice little piece of writing there. It's because you get a literal visual example of minimizing of Walt, and it's very well done. Just doing it that way, they did that deliberately that way. So yeah, I think I don't know. Maybe Mike would have made it to the second half of season 5. Maybe. But it's interesting because with Mike, you know, you can appreciate that he's doing the right thing, you know, because he's trying to make sure his guys are made whole again. And I love that phrasing, by the way, though, make whole again. I always love that way of putting it. But at the same time, I don't want to put this curmudgeon on a pedestal just yet because this is more about self-preservation than anything else. It's not, let's not make him like he's, you know, the boy, the hitman boy scout that he sometimes comes off as.
I got a question for Brian. What's the point of Mike's lawyer putting headphones on? I mean, he already knows about, like, you know, all these other guys because, you know, they have to go visit him and he knows exactly where they are and stuff. So can you really explain why he would, as a lawyer yourself who tends to, you know, do errands for drug lords and stuff, what his motivation would be in doing that with the headphones?
What his lawyer was doing was keeping plausible deniability. So that whatever exactly was said, if there was any information that you know, he didn't need to hear, he couldn't hear it, he couldn't be asked about it, and he couldn't divulge it. So, and there are certain duties that if you hear talk of certain things like, you know, imminent death, as an officer of the court, you have a duty to report that. Like if somebody says, I'm going right now to kill someone, you know, and they then go and kill someone, you know, that's one of the only times that you can say anything. So my guess is that, you know, to keep plausible deniability, he turned the headphones on. Now, the flip side of that is if you went in the room with Mike and like a guy ends up getting killed because of that, I don't think it's a great defense to say I sat there with headphones on. But I think it's probably more like if he's ever questioned, he's not going to act nervous or look, you know, look like he's lying because he actively knows what was said and is lying about it.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's why we have you here, Brian. There you go. So I'm going to run through a few other of the fun things throughout this episode because there is a lot of fun stuff in it. I love all the possible lab locations, that whole sequence. That's just great. The fact that once you realize we're going to see multiple, once we get to like wherever the second one was, which might have been the one with the tortillas or the empanadas, you know they're going to go to, we're going to see the laser tag place show up again. even though it's like, nope.
Yeah.
But this all obviously brings us to another major intro, the Vamanos Pest intro, which means this is also the episode where we meet Todd for the first time. Todd. And I remember watching at the time being really excited that, oh, they're bringing in someone from Friday Night Lights. And actually, it turns out there's multiple people from Friday Night Lights on the show at this point, which I had forgotten about at the time, but now I know it to be true. Because the actress who plays Andrea, Jesse's woman, she was also on Friday Night Lights. She was a delinquent student on there a number of times. But this is the episode for everyone who just knew Jesse Plemons at the time from Friday Night Lights. The introduction of Todd, we're like, oh, look, it's him. And we didn't know it was going to happen a couple episodes later. She was going to make us go, oh, what? What happened? What was his character? I can't remember what his character's name was on Friday Night Lights. It just moved out of my head. But
Landry.
Like, oh, Landry. What the fuck? I was like, what the fuck, Landry? Anyway. Give me a second here. I'm just like kind of hit fast forward here. So,
we'll see Ira in the final season of Better Call Saul, since him and Saul clearly have a well established relationship. You think maybe there'll be like a scene where he's representing him?
Yeah, maybe I think that's possible. I mean, hell, when we saw the trailer, the fact that they got Spooge in the trailer for the final season of Better Call Saul, I think anything's possible. I was like, Spooge! Spooge! So happy. Don't bring back Wendy, but they bring back Spooge. Fuckers. And then speaking of the Vominos Pest guys and Ira and Todd and all them, I did enjoy the scene. And this kind of shows what Mike is good at and why he's there. I love Mike instructing them. And that the whole little, going through all that with them and how you never talk to these guys. Their name, what is it? Are their names Yes Sir and No Sir? Is that
what? Yeah.
I really enjoyed that quite a lot. Try to think of other things I really enjoyed about this episode. You guys can obviously jump in with anything that occurs to you. I'll toss a light one in here. How awesome was it to see Skinny Pete and Badger again? And it's also weird when we get to this episode, how far Jesse has come since his days of dealing and slinging with these two guys. Because when you see them in this episode, everything, his manner of speaking, his clothes, the way he's carrying himself, it's like now he's hanging out with children. You know, especially when you have someone like Badger there who really is, like an overgrown man-child. And is this the episode, the first time we see Skinny Pete playing piano? And we're like, oh wow. I think that's his
episode. Oh, he's like killing it at that keyboard. And Badger sucks at guitar, but Skinny Pete's really good at piano.
So beyond that, then we get let's get to Skylar here. I remember at the time it was, I mean, God knows it's definitely a gif if not a meme, the whole shut up with Marie scene. And I remember way back when I was thinking, I should look on YouTube. I bet someone's done it, where I need a mashup of Skylar's breakdown and Jack Nicholson's presidential tirade from Mars Attacks, where he keeps yelling shut up over and over. Just splice those two together. It's just in this whole sequence where she always thought that Walt was just in over his head, a small player in a much bigger picture, and she was always willing to do whatever was best for the family, and now she's realizing it's quite different than that, and that's, which then takes us to later on, what Dan brought up before, the whole Walt talking to Marie and revealing what Skylar had done and using that as the excuse for what her behavior is. Is it wrong that even as I'm saying it, I feel bad saying this. I kind of find that I found it weirdly funny that the way he was tossing her under the bus to Marie. I know it's the wrong reaction, but I couldn't help it.
Oh yeah. That's definitely like, I can see that in a dark humor sort of way.
Well, I don't know that what he does is funny. It's Marie's reaction to it that I think is, for me, is the humor, because, of course, Marie, gets up and gives him the big hug and oh, like basically is like, oh, you poor thing. Like, Marie is Marie always tries to emotionally manipulate with guilt, and he uses what she does like right back on her.
Right.
And I think that's probably what's so satisfying about is to see like him use the guilt of her prying and telling her this thing, and her reaction to it, I think, is what creates the dark humor in it.
Right, right, right. Well, it's interesting because at this point, and again, I'm somewhat reiterating things that have been said in previous podcasts, but Skylar at this point, she's more than just simply complicit. She's actively participating in criminal activity, you know, which, as I've said a number of times, makes perfect sense because I keep saying she's a better liar than Walt. And you can even see in earlier episodes that there was a clear thrill she got out of doing it as well. And this is all, but we were talking about the way she is now, is the Skylar's realization that Walt is actually a murderer and a cold, calculating one at that, the way he responded to her question at the end of the finale, you know, kind of tells her that. That's all kind of fried her brain. But then when she walks into the living room and she sees Walt and Walt Jr. watching the promo, oh Lord, how meta are they? Watching the promo for AMC's Mob Week. I mean, and which is, you know, Scarface. It's probably about as unsubtle as this show will ever get. Her reaction. Because it's a moment I thought was both humorous and kind of chilling at the same time. It's not quite, you know, Walt and Brock chilling, because that look that Walt gives the kid is the official, Walt is giving me the heebie-jeebies moment of the episode, I think. But it's still kind of unsettling all the same, because, you know, and I think that really feeds into her wanting to get her kids out of that house, is when she sees the two of them together and how they're enjoying what they're watching and everything. I think that kind of, even if it's a subconsciously affects her, kind of like, okay, we got to get my kids out of the house, away from this man. That's the way I read it, at least.
Yeah, I mean, you know, not that I had, like, you know, Amish or prudish parents, but, you know, I didn't sit down with my mom and dad and watch Scarface and eat popcorn. You know, like, I that was probably a bridge too far for my parents. And the sort of humorous slash chilling thing is when they shoot the shot from the point of view of the TV back into the room, that, you know, he's sitting there with Holly on his lap, like, you know, this little baby, just sitting there watching this, like, you know, extremely violent thing. And they're yakking it up and eating popcorn. And I think that was sort of, I don't want to say not appropriate because that's not strong enough, but it just seemed wrong.
It did, although I was exposed to pretty much all manner of movies as a small child, so I can't really fault on it.
But and look how well adjusted you turned out.
All right, go fuck yourself, Brian.
I watch brutal stuff with my kids sometimes too. In fact, three minutes ago, my son texted me and said, "Holy fuck, the Batman is good."
He actually said, "Holy fuck!" Wow.
He did.
How old is he again?
16.
Oh, okay. Oh, the daughter is right. She's the younger one. I keep forgetting.
I don't got her swearing yet, but once she starts working in a few months, then maybe.
She's working in the fields. Yeah, it was. I mean, again, it's another really strong episode, and, you know, lots of great Saul Goodman stuff in this episode as well. Was there anything else that stuck out for you guys before we move to the next one?
One thing, and I don't know if it was this episode or last that we didn't talk about, that it just popped in my head, was the scene where Hank's talking to his one of the people in the office. I don't remember if it was the boss or whatever. And the guy says, "I can't believe, like, the picture, I looked at the picture of Frang, and, you know, he was right there in front of me the whole time under my nose." And basically, like, the camera is focusing on Hank, like, sort of talking about how, you know, Frang was a friend to the law enforcement and had been to this guy's house and they'd grilled out. And then we move from that you know, to immediately the next episode, Hank going to a house to a cookout right there with Walt. And it's a nice bit of writing that, that foreshadows, you know, the same situation Hank's in is what the, I don't know, was it the ASAC, Dan, that was talking to Hank that gets replaced?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Like him talking about Hank. And I thought that was, you know, it was a scene that, that watching it now, you can watch it like maybe Hank subconsciously something's registering, or maybe it's just, you know, saying to the viewer, like, hey, look, we know this is the situation Hank's in. I watched it like a couple of times, and I don't know if something's registering with Hank or if maybe subconsciously the seed's planted there. But I thought that was a scene that, that I should mention.
Yeah, it was in the previous episode I mentioned the parallel of what ASAC Merkert was talking about him and Fring was really was talking about Hank and Walt and how Hank doesn't, only Hank doesn't know it yet, but everything he's saying basically applies to Hank's relationship with Walt. So yes, the fact that they're at a the fact that he's at a little cookout the very next or an episode or two later with Walt kind of echoes that. So there's kind of there's a nice little unexpected foreshadowing there. So that's kind of nice. You're right. In fact, we're going to get to that episode now, which is the fourth episode, which is 51, which was one of those few episodes directed by Rian Johnson and written by Sam Catlin. And for some reason, I had focused on the quote, nothing stops this train, because, oh, look, it's, you know, you're telling us what's going to happen in another episode. Much like a Jesse James reference who robbed trains. Huh? They're totally foreshadowing the train episode, which is going to be in our next podcast. Anyway, this episode for me, I think was just really about the, a lot of it was about the realization of just how dire Skylar's situation has become. You know, the fact that she thought she was married to a man who'd gotten in over his head and was looking for a way out, but then it obviously is what I was just saying just a few moments ago, that she made herself an active participant in illegal activities in order to help him and keep the family together and safe. And, you know, you can go through the timeline with her and when things started to the unraveling of Skylar. You know, the first harsh note with her, between her and Walt, might, you can go, if you, you don't have to go back too far, you can just go back to like the midway through the fourth season, the whole, when Walt declares himself to be the danger, the one who knocks, whatever. Then we later find her at a literal crossroads in another episode. And although luck or fate or destiny was pointing her in the direction of one state, she again makes the decision to stay. Because, as we said, she has to be the one who protects the, this family from the one who protects this family. Now, here's the thing where I think this is where we are in the pro-Skylar camp, because she's fucking right. You know, it's, as you guys were pointing out before, you know, there were men coming to that house to kill the family. It's by sheer providence that the White family hasn't been wiped out a few times over already at this point. So it goes to what you were saying before about, you know, it's about Walt. It's whether it's his obstinate nature, his growing ego, his hubris. He's responsible for putting his family directly in harm's way. I mean, for him or anyone to think otherwise means you're paddling into the rapids of denial. And then when she finds out her husband is actually indeed a murderer, and like I said before, a calculating murderer at that, you know, who has no intention of getting out of the business because now he's actually the guy in charge. I mean, we're watching her have this, she's on the verge of a breakdown throughout the first few episodes of the season, and then, you know, culminating what happens at the I guess we can call it the cookout, whatever. At least they're eating a meal outside. It's no wonder. You know, I mean, she's a pube hair away from a mental breakdown. It's like, I mean, look, we talked earlier about that a couple episodes ago where Walt was downright rapey with her, you know? If that makes you, and if that made you feel a touch uncomfortable, then you really should understand what her mindset is at this point. So when you have that scene, it's like the important scene of the episode, I think, when she takes a walk to the bottom of the pool it's not a genuine suicide attempt, but it's an act of desperation. It's an act of depression. It is a cry for help, you know? But it's also much the way Walt does, because, you know, they have their similarities, these two. It's a very calculated move by Skylar as well. This is her way. She knows what she's doing. She's not having a mental break. She knows what she's doing. She wants to get the children out of the house. What's the better way to do that than to exhibit behavior like this in front of Marie and Hank? So that way it doesn't seem that much that bizarre when she asks that they take care of the children for the time being. Because Marie, she even says it's Skylar's idea. Because Skylar is not dumb. She knows that the plan isn't that good. It's probably kind of bad and risky as anything her husband has ever, frankly, concocted. But she's not dumb. And the fact is that for all of Walt's badass behavior as he belittles and berates her, you know, and it's a great scene. It's one of the great scenes of the show, I think. And it's very reminiscent of it reminds me a little bit, for people who are Sopranos fans, when Tony and Carmela had a huge showdown in a famous episode of The Sopranos where they were just, you know, nonstop fighting with each other. But here is what Brian was saying before. I think when Skylar delivers the nastiest verbal kick in the guts after he knocks down all of her options by saying that she will just wait for the cancer to come back. That's, to me, that's like the dramatic wow moment of the episode, maybe of the season so far for me. So I know I just went on a little bit of a spiel there. I apologize. I just wanted to get that all out because it was in my head. So you guys can have at it for a few minutes here.
I totally agree with your assessment. And I think the first time I watched this, I thought maybe she genuinely like just wanted to die. This time watching it and watching it back to back to back and sitting with it four episodes in a row, I saw what I thought was interesting is that she actually does a manipulation the way Walt would, but it's to genuinely what in her mind is help the family. It's not selfish because she's staying behind. Like she's not getting anything out of it. When Walt creates these manipulations, it's to make himself look better or achieve some goal. She's actually sacrificing in this because to her family, like she looks like she's the one in trouble. You know, she makes herself look bad for the benefit of her kids. And if you look at it that way, that's the only way she can get them out, based on what Walt has said, that, you know, it in a way it's almost sort of noble in a way.
Yeah, you can do an interesting contrast what she does here, what she does and her motivation for it and what it achieves, and compared to, say, I don't know, Walt faking his fugue state and going through all that, and how, you know, it still tends to be questioned by people. It's everyone felt it was a little, there was something a little hinky going on there, and why he did it, whatever. And what she does is a much neater, cleaner, and more believable way of going about it. That just popped into my head. I was like, oh yeah, it's like I'm in the fugue state. So it's an episode where we're commemorating Walt's birthday and his 1-year anniversary of his cancer diagnosis. As I'm watching the episode, especially that fight scene, which is tremendous, I had suspected this was the episode that Anna Gunn had submitted for the Emmy. I looked it up. It was. And she won. Well done, Anna Gunn. You knew what you were doing. So we can kind of pop through the episode in general. Well, this is the one that has the whole opening. Is it the opening? Whatever. I just wrote Boys and Cars. So this is where Walt kind of sheds the whole, no, we can't get an expensive car for him, whatever. And he buys them both, multi-thousand-dollar cars there. Well, I guess all cars are multi-thousand. That's a stupid thing. You know what I mean?
I can't watch that scene anymore without thinking of like the Mentos commercial version of it that somebody made at some point.
That's right. And it's nice that I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think he gets Junior the car, the same car that he had before, because I think it's a Challenger again.
I think it's the same car. Right. If not, it's pretty damn close.
But yeah, we know it's not the same car as that one. Yeah. Huh. It's a burning heap somewhere. But okay,
which is an additional indignity to Skylar.
Oh, absolutely.
To get the exact same car, to be like, you made me, you know, you made us take it back. F you, I'm getting it again.
Right. So I'm flipping through the episode now. It was funny because watching it, I had forgotten, and I had to rewind. I actually even had to rewind it. When they established that the magical office where Lydia is located in Houston, Texas. I was like, oh, okay, that makes a lot more sense. I love the bit, and it took me a minute to the rewind thing, and I think Hank actually is the one to mention it later on, that she's so frazzled, I guess, from what had happened with Mike, that she's wearing the mismatched shoes. I love the mismatched shoes. I love
that. Yeah, Gomi says, like, she's too tightly wound and he goes, well, she wasn't so tightly wound that she couldn't wear or she wore mismatching shoes. Like he picked up that detail that there was something off about her.
Right. Trying to think of anything else that was really, I love the little details. I love the fact that when Walt comes home, it's not simply that Skylar is smoking. It's that she's using his birthday mug to tap her ashes into. Not that, of course, having a birthday mug is a little cheesy to begin with, but I just love that she's using that. It's just driving point the home, like, yeah, I'm waiting for your cancer to come back as I tap my cigarette ash into your mug. I really enjoy that. There's something about this episode, which I guess is a little bit important, and I'll just from a symbolic perspective. It's in this episode, Walt replaces or has replaced. He replaces his car, which is a bigger deal than maybe we might think, than maybe one might think, because that car, that Aztec, was really a representation of the person he was, you know, because it's always been kind of a strange car. It's not a car you see very commonly, whatever. So it's a little odd and idiosyncratic. Not the most impressive looking of vehicles, you know. It really seemed, I mean, they picked the cars very specifically to match the characters. We've talked about that before, whether it be on Better Call Saul or Breaking Bad. They're very precise about that, and this might be the epitome of them. So the fact that gets rid of that car, he basically sells it for $50, in fact, and replaces it with what he ends up with, you know, is just one more wow. Walt is totally not chained, but the transformation is really kicking in here. The other thing which we kind of might forget about. And then you have to go all the way to the final episode where we see it referenced. It's the watch. It's first of all the fact that Jesse has gotten a watch, which is very. He does seem genuinely touched by it. He's definitely, you know, especially considering what's going on in his own home regarding his birthday. But then you realize, oh, up until this point, he's had kind of a dorky, geeky, you know, he's had a calculator watch, for God's sake. Who the hell still wears those? I remember that in the 80s, man. But, you know, it's the science nerdy kind of watch. And that's now jettisoned and replaced with, you know, this expensive, sleek model, much like his car. It's just showing how he's moved up the ranks. So I think so I remember when people watched the finale, there was some confusion about, I think there's a scene early on where he leaves the watch somewhere. And people always were, I don't understand what the watch meant. And I want to say, you probably forgot you know, the fourth episode of the season and what that watch meant and why he had it. That, you know, that's why he abandons it. Anyway, I just thought it was interesting because you have those things happening in this episode, and then you also have him finding the Heisenberg hat again, which if maybe the biggest symbolic thing in the entire series of how important it is to him and how it always represents his conversion or transformation into the Heisenberg character. But there's that one little moment, and I love it. Again, it's just a, I just love the little touch like that. When he's looking at the hat and you see that single little thread, the hat is just a little bit, hat's never been frayed before. We've never seen that. And the fact that just seeing that, and you know, Walt is all about the details. This is the guy who, you know, in the waiting room spends time, you know, shoving like the little piece of paper or matchbook, whatever it was, you know, to straighten the table when everyone's worried about Hank's going to die or not. He's all about the little specificity of life. Him staring at the thread, it's, you know, you almost expect, is he going to try to trim it? Is he going to pull on it? Whatever. The thread itself, it's just, it's this foreshadowing of the unraveling of him, of his business, of his private life, of everything. Even if it's going to take place over the next few weeks or months or however you look at it, it's definitely kind of, it's definitely a visual hint of things to come when you, with that. And again, it's as simple as a fucking thread. I that's the kind of stuff I love.
Yeah, that was great visual storytelling. And I have to say, I have to confess something. I actually drove an Aztec. My mom owned one. And she is probably the antithesis of who Walter White becomes. And that's probably why they picked that car to start with. Because if you knew my mom or know my mom, she is, you know, about as mild-mannered, non-confrontational as you could have. But I think him selling the Aztec for next to nothing is symbolic that he values his prior life very little at this point, that he's all in on the new life. And, you know, with the hat, with the watch, getting rid of his car, you know, he's fully embracing the person that's going to destroy everything in the next bit of episodes. I mean, he's putting the black hat on and loving it, and hubris, whatever it is that led him there, you know. It is odd, like, if, because even Junior says, "Dad, like, what, $50?" Like, and he's like, you know, who cares? Like, he doesn't really, he gives the car away basically,
right?
So yeah, that thread is, you know, the first, it's starting to unravel. And I think that thread is right when he says, like, nobody's like slowing down, or I forget the phrase. I think you said it earlier, like, nobody's stopping this train, or he says something like that. When he's looking at it, he's sitting in the seat with Jesse and Mike, and Mike says, you know, if we have to slow down, we slow down. And Walt says, no, we're not slowing down. When they're talking about the methylamine.
Right. Nothing stops this train. That's the line, which I think, guess what happens in the very next episode? Oh, train. There you go. Wow.
Yeah.
They're brilliant. was there anything else you guys wanted to jump in about this episode that occurred to you?
I noticed the, like, Don Eladio and Tyrus's last names on the chart. I don't think I really know. I knew him before on the DEA's, like, this is the big picture of the Fring organization crime chart thing. So.
Oh, yeah. Right.
I do like the detail of discovering the bug on the methylamine and Mike figuring out it's Lydia and talking about, like, you know, he's going to get her. And we had the scene in one of the earlier episodes where he threatens her but agrees to let her live for the methylamine. And in this, like, you know, Jesse again is trying to save someone's life. You know, because as you said, Scott, he's become the heart of the show. He's like the fan going, you know, don't be this evil. Don't do this stuff. And he says something like, you don't know this woman. She deserves to die maybe more than any man I've ever met or something like that. You know, like,
and I like how he refers to himself as sexist for not killing her.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Amazing. I just want to give a shout out to the guy who's working on the Aztec, making a comment about the, for once, not having to replace the windshield.
Yeah.
He goes, that windshield's been damaged. I think that was damaged at least 3 times that I can recall at this point.
Yeah. And you have the sort of Goodfellas illusion, like, you know, had to clean up where you hit that deer.
Oh yeah.
Think of, you know, right. But anyway, hit one of them deers, Mom.
Forgot about that. That's good. All righty then. So, as we wrap up these first 4 episodes, any other TV stuff that's on your guys' mind you wanted to bring up before we close up the podcast? I should have asked you this beforehand so I would have known what you were going to say, and I wouldn't have asked you.
I finished Mayor of Kingstown. I liked it. And I watched the first half of 1883. And I also liked it. Both on Paramount, whatever.
What have I watched? I finished the Righteous Gemstones. New season.
I did as well.
And have to say, like, I mean, if you liked the Danny McBride sort of over the top world, it was enjoyable, interesting casting with Eric Andre as, you know, a rival preacher this season, and let's just say there's some really awesome, ridiculous moments with the God Squad that occur, but you know, enjoyed it. It was a fun watch, so I caught that, and so if you like Danny McBride's other stuff. And I thought this season, John Goodman sort of took a nice little bit of a dramatic turn. Eric Roberts is an interesting character addition to the season. I thought it was enjoyable. If you like that stuff, check it out.
I actually watched it based on, mainly Jamie had told me to check it out a number of times. A couple other people, I think at least one, if not two different people named Tiffany also told me to watch it. So I caught up with it just before they got to their final 2 episodes. So I was able to finish it. And I remember saying, a show with John Goodman and Walton Goggins, I got to give it a shot. It didn't even occur to me, because I did like Vice Principals as well. I never watched East Side and Down, which is funny because that's the baseball one. You think I'm a baseball guy, I would have seen that one, but I've still not.
Eastbound and Down is really funny, and I like Vice Principals, but I just couldn't get into Righteous Gemstones. I watched maybe 4 episodes, and I just didn't like it, unfortunately.
Well, this season, I will say, I didn't say it before, I feel like I need to you know, repent. But you know, Baby Billy could be one of Walton Goggins' most outrageous and ridiculous funny characters.
Well, and he's got some great moments. Yeah.
Yeah. There's some great moments out of him this season.
Oh man. And the genius of casting Macaulay Culkin as his, grown up son was, wow, spot on. Really. I really enjoyed that. Anything else that I've watched? I started and finished Archive 81 in the last week or so. I thought it was very well done. I related to it to a certain degree because certain parts of it take place right in the area where I used to work. And what I used to do for a living wasn't exactly what this guy did, but I am connected to, and I know a lot of people in the archivist field who do things where they're preserving or saving both photography and video and stuff. So I kind of understood what he was doing in a different way. I liked it because it kind of, it it melded some fun horror tropes together and into one series. You've got a very Rosemary's Baby-esque quality to all the weird goings-ons at this specific building, which definitely and when, as you're watching it, you know, well, there's something very Satan-y going on here, or something along those lines, or some demon, whatever. You know, they're all one demon or another, whatever. So you have that going on. And yet they also, and they even make references to the characters themselves in the show. They also give us a little bit of The Shining as far as the main character that we're following, or one of the two main characters that we're following, is doing the restoration in a place of isolation, and is he being impacted by him being alone out here? And when he watches a video of one of the previous person who had worked there and how he was impacted. I mean, they drop Jack Torrance references in it, you know, so it's that they know exactly what they're doing. And I made a joking reference on our Facebook page where I said it was because of me joking about the fact that I hadn't revealed my opinion on the Batman movie online as of yet. So I said something along the lines of, I know you've been waiting for me to give you this hot take. And then it was Archive 81 is greater than Midnight Mass. I actually do believe that to be true, though. Only because I just thought that this, I mean, they're both series that are based in the world of horror. I mean, there may be different forms of it, but at the end of the day, it's the same genre. So therefore it's a fair comparison. And I also like the fact that, and actually there's something I think they do on Midnight Mass too. And some other shows that we've all watched where, maybe, if not usually like the penultimate episode, they'll do an episode which suddenly takes place, you know, 50 or 100 years earlier. They certainly did that in the wasn't it, Brian, the name of the guy who did Midnight Mass, what's his name?
Mike Flanagan.
He certainly did that in his previous one, the one in between Haunting of Hill House and Midnight Mass, the second one. Is it the Bly Manor one?
Yeah. Haunting of Bly Manor.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, isn't like the next to last episode kind of take place way in the past and then they come back to the present? They started to do something like that in this show as well. And I remember, and I'm halfway through that episode and I'm thinking, I kind of know where this is leading. I don't know why it's kind of cool, but it's kind of a waste of my time until a character drops a comment and realize, oh, I'm not just waiting for one person to die. Apparently they're all going to die. Oh, I didn't know that was going to happen. Oh, I'm all on board now. and I'm looking forward to them. There has to be a second season of this damn show. If anything, they kind of I don't want to give away everything. They kind of underplayed the ending.
Yeah.
It kind of ends on kind of a, you know, blah, and they make it kind of like a,
I checked it out and I liked it. I enjoyed it. And it harkened back like to what you were saying to that sort of, there used to be that sort of specific genre, like, hey, there's something wrong with this building or this house. Like, you know, that anybody that goes there, like strange things are going on, and, having it sort of centered in and set in that one apartment building, and then the remote place having those sort of two focused locations really made it interesting, because you sort of got to explore the neighbors and what was going on in the place. Yeah. It was like Only Murders in the Building, except with Satan.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was thinking.
And not nearly as funny, but I thought it, and it came along with very little fanfare. You know, it I don't know how well it did, but you know, it was one of those things. I watched it fairly soon after it came out and enjoyed it. So I pretty much agree with what you said. I liked the way a lot of the found footage wasn't necessarily scary, but it gave you a sense of foreboding,
right,
that led to the present fear.
Right. Although they do come up with one major, massive, great jump scare in this series, where I had a liquid in my hand, it would have been everywhere. which again reminded me of the Flanagan series, where there's always that one moment, you know, and it's like, oh, they got that moment pretty. They got it in the third episode of this one. Not much of a spoiler. I also, when you're gonna do something in that genre, specifically horror, when you establish the story and the rules as fast as they do in this, and they do it really fast, I'm very impressed by that. It's like, oh, here's my story. Here's where it is. Let's go. And then they start folding in things where I was like, oh, okay. Didn't know that's where we were going to go here. Didn't know the character was going to experience things with what he's watching and from videos from the 90s, whatever. As it went further, every time they surprised me, I was impressed by that, and that made me enjoy the series more. And you're right, it's weird that it didn't get quite as much attention. And that, I've talked about this online recently, maybe that's how I'll end this segment, maybe, just on this thought. It's something to be said for not using the release everything at once Netflix binge model. And I know a lot of us prefer that because that way we can watch it whenever we want. It's all there, blah, blah, blah. But as far as a show receiving notice and getting more talked about and being in the public consciousness, that format works against it. Because all the show, if you think about generally speaking, and there are exceptions, I know what they are already, but generally speaking, the shows that get the most conversation going and most interest and thus get more viewership are ones that we're talking about week after week. That's why Disney doesn't release all of Mandalorian all at once. It does it week to week. That's why the Marvel series like Hawkeye or like Loki or whatever, WandaVision was released week to week. They released, for, you know, two episodes maybe at first and then week to same kind of thing. That's why Amazon is doing that now, because it builds,
yes,
it builds conversation and gets us. Peacemaker became the biggest show of the, you know, it might remain the biggest show of the year because they released it that way. And we were talking about it week after week. You do it all at once. Yeah, and it kind of fizzles. I'm sorry, Dan. I'm going to talk over you.
Yeah, just like, you know, like the second season of Star Trek Picard's out now. And it's just, you know, I've been talking to one of my friends about it. It's just easier to talk like after the episode if you just watched one episode and you don't have to like, oh, how far are you? Oh.
Right.
It just makes it easier to like talk about stuff. And even with shows, like Yellowstone, for example, is really popular. Same thing, you know, that doesn't come out every week. They stagger them and stuff like that. And I just, you know, as somebody who takes forever to get to stuff anyway, it doesn't, you know, really bother me how they release stuff, period. But
right. I mean, and I know I was having, when I was looking online, someone who I think I'll classify her as an occasional listener. I don't think she listens to every podcast, but I know she's listened to some of them. You know, she felt the opposite. And again, there's nothing wrong with feeling that way. I'm not saying it's the wrong way to feel, but I'm trying to make a point. But that's going to help the show in the long run, because when you build that interest and it gets more talked about, first of all, it's more fun to talk about a show with other people that way anyway, like you just said, as opposed to having the what are you up to conversation. And it also, if it's increasing interest and popularity and whatever, it increases the likelihood they're going to come back for a second season. That's kind of the big point there. And that's why, like, it's weird. And the show I use as a comparison, and I'm not doing this because Brian's on the podcast, but, you know, Ozark got released, and you got, you know, they just released the, I guess it's like the first half of the season, whatever you want to call it. But it was, seven episodes? Was it 10?
Yeah, I think so. And I watched them in like a day and a half, right. And like, you almost forget it didn't happen. They could have just done one a week, and then guess what? It comes back in 3 weeks or whatever.
And I think that was a problem because I know a lot of people watch it, and it kind of just, it came and went, and now, but then no one's talking about it anymore. And that kind of works again. That's why, that's one of the bad things about that model. Think, I mean, I keep thinking how much more popular and yes, in this country, Dark would have been if that had been released, you know, on a weekly basis, because people would have been talking and theorizing. It would have been like Lost all over again.
Yeah. I think the biggest point in favor of what you're saying is, like right now we have more content than we've ever had. Like, if you make me wait a week for something I really like, it's not like I don't have other things to watch, or, you know, there isn't something else I can binge. And the things that are dropped immediately, they have a very disposable quality that when you're waiting and thinking of, if you think about something for 6 weeks, it sticks with you longer than something you think about for 3 days.
Right.
And it's just, you know, it's just that simple. And, you know, like, I mean, for instance, like what we're doing tonight, we're not talking about a whole season of Breaking Bad. We're talking about four episodes. Like we, you know, we've broken it down into something so you can actually talk and think about it. If you do a whole season podcast and everybody watches a whole season, there's so much you're not thinking about, you're not considering, that you just can't remember. The human brain can't remember. And it's I think the joy of something being good and making you wait is worth it. And I think, like, you know, you and I about Peacemaker, you get, you know, 48 minutes, and when it's over, you want more. Like, if we'd have binged Peacemaker, we'd have probably talked about how great it was, but I don't know that we would have considered it as great as it is, because we wouldn't have looked at all the parts individually. And, you know, if you have 8 great episodes and you think about them each for a week, that's going to seem better than something you watch one time, consider one unit, and say it was really good.
Right. Right.
Yeah, and it definitely can make for a different experience. But, you know, just even with this podcast, I mean, me and Scott did Dark seasons 1 and 2 in their own podcast, and then for the final season, Scott humored my odd and probably more time consuming than needed to be suggestion of breaking it up into individual episodes. And all the podcasts we did were good, but it's, you know, definitely a different experience, like having to slow down and like talk about it a little bit, and then, you know. Anyway, I guess we'd have to ask the like 4 listeners to the podcast what's more enjoyable. I guess comparing.
We have more than 4 listeners. Don't. despite what's, you know, I'm not going to go down that road. I swore. I wasn't going to do that.
Yeah,
but you know,
not vengeance.
No, right, but we don't have the most outstanding listener numbers, but they're not as bad as people think they are, or as I make them out to be. Because everything that's revealed on that post host site is not actually all the listeners that we have. I think when we were talking during the best of 2021 thing, it was kind of like why I didn't want a show like What We Do in the Shadows to be all released at once, because I liked having that to look forward to.
Yeah, exactly.
But I'm not going to say I want that to be for everything. I also love when, you know, they drop an entire season of Big Mouth and I can just binge a bunch of Big Mouth episodes, because I just love watching a bunch of those in a row. So I'm not like that about everything.
But maybe I think, like, if you want to dump Cobra Kai.
Oh yeah, Cobra Kai is that's a perfect cool show.
Like, yeah. That's a perfect binge show, and it, you know, as it was popular, you can dump a whole season and nobody is upset that it binged and it's over, and everybody looks forward to next season and it's a fun binge. But a show like Ozark would benefit from the pacing of spacing it out and being able to talk about it, and, you know, and like, you know, the show we're talking about, Archive 81, I think the mystery and the way it was, I think people would have really talked about it and been into it if it had a chance to grow.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Exactly. Because, again, especially when you're talking about dramatic series, you know, anything that's got any sort of element of mystery or suspense or, you know, the puzzle aspect to it, whatever, are always going to benefit from that. And you know that when you go back in time for, like, again, like a show like Lost, or even if you go to shows like, you know, like The X-Files and then stuff like that, or Twin Peaks, those shows benefit from that because, you know, it's what makes them kind of fun. I mean, is the fact that you can kind of talk about it with other people or read stuff online, or if you're one of those people who likes Reddit, you go there, whatever, you know? When it's all digested, dumped all at once, you don't get that opportunity. So, that's all. I'm just saying. I think it worked. If they had done a different kind of model for Archive 81, it's like what you just said. I think it might have been a bigger deal, and I think it works against a lot of shows in the same way. And that's all I have to say about that.
pretty good.
Yeah. I don't want to binge Curb Your Enthusiasm. I like the one. Anyway, just me. Another example. People, all those great HBO shows, you know.
Exactly.
You could fucking wait. God damn it. Anyway. So, hopefully, y'all out there, if you enjoyed this podcast, you know what? You'll probably enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page as well. I've made enough references to it. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. You can like the page and join the conversation about shows like Breaking Bad, like pretty much like anything we've already mentioned or anything you'd like to mention. You can find our podcast, well, wherever you found it in the first place, because you're listening to it already. But you can also find it in places like Apple Podcast, Amazon Music, Spotify, and so on. You know, we're good buddies with Joe Rogan and stuff. I don't know why I said that. But better still, you can find all of our podcasts, even the ones that for some reason say forbidden. Ignore that. Click on the link. It'll take you to another page, and then you can listen to them. It's a weird thing. I don't understand it, but don't ask me. But you go to stvdpodcast.podbean.com, and all 330, I don't know what number of podcasts we're up to. I forgot to write. I'm going to say 334 of our podcasts are there. If I'm wrong, I apologize. No one cares if I'm wrong. You can also follow us on Instagram. Our Instagram is, Serious TV Drama as one word. And, of course, you can follow us on Twitter. We occasionally comment on things or as well as send out links there. And the handle there is at STVDS. Wow. At I'm sick and I'm tired. At STVD Podcast. STVD as in Serious TV Drama.
That's the name of the podcast. Yep.
Fucking asshole. So, we will be joining forces again, probably in less than 24 hours from this recording, where at least the three of us, there might be a fourth, don't know, we'll be talking about some movie with a guy with pointy ears and stuff that came out recently. Beyond that, obviously, we will be covering the next four episodes of Breaking Bad in the next couple weeks. We do feel we'll probably get the Breaking Bad rewatch done just in time. We hope to get it done just before Better Call Saul starts. If schedules don't permit, then we might have to have a doubling up, and hopefully we're going to try to avoid that because time is a precious commodity for all of us involved in this podcast, I think. So I think we're going to try to get it wrapped up the week before Better Call Saul starts, which is on, as I said it would, starts on April 18th.
All right. You nailed it.
Well, I kind of said April 11th or April 18th, and I was kind of leaning more towards the 18th, but still good. All right, so Brian, thank you so much for joining us this evening. Always look forward to talking to you, and we'll do so again tomorrow.
It was great to talk to both.
Yeah, it's always
nice. It was great to be on here with you.
There you go. And Daniel, always. A rich experience, enriching experience to talk with you. So there's
that. Yeah, I think you guys both covered that pretty good. I don't have anything else to add to that.
Oh boy! All right. So with that, thank you for listening, and good night to everybody out there. And I'll let you guys say do your good nights as well, and then I'll click the button.
Good night.
We're such pros.